Quick announcements, or at least one, before we begin here. We have set the date for the annual business meeting of the members, which by the bylaws has to be done within the first quarter of each calendar year, for February 28th. If you are a member, you are welcome to attend. If not, you can either become a member before then or not attend. That's your call. That is the one announcement. And if you are interested in becoming a member, we have all the bylaws on the internet. You can easily access them. You have to read them and make sure that you agree, essentially, with the fact that the leadership is the leadership of the local church and is to be followed. Okay, well, let's make sure you're in fellowship and continue on here. We're actually working on the exegesis, verse 3. Verse 2, the noise of the whip, the noise of the rattling of the wheel, galloping horses and bounding chariots. Horsemen charging, spears flashing, swords flashing, rather, spears gleaming. We're up to the spears gleaming here, and actually, you have the, again, another word that's related to light, like lahav, the first one there. This one is barak, which means lightning or glittering, B-A-R-A-Q. Lightning or glittering or bright, and then you got the word kaneth, which means a spear. C-H-A-Y-N-I-T-H. So spear flashing or gleaming is the way they've translated it here, which is fine. An abundance. You got a wow here. And again, for whatever reason, I'm not real clear on why the New American Standard has just chosen to ignore every wow in these two verses. Or if they haven't, they've just translated them as commas. There are connectives all throughout here. So you have a wow plus a masculine singular noun of rove, R-O-V-H, which means a multitude or abundance. And then kalal is the masculine singular noun. It comes from a root that means to pierce something through. So they've translated many slain, but this would include people who weren't dead yet. This would include those who were probably fatally wounded but had not died right by that second. Because this gets into the next one, deals with the already dead. A mass of corpses. You've got a wow here plus the masculine singular noun of COVID. K-O-V-H-E-D-H, COVID, means literally to be heavy or massive. Massive amounts of corpses, and they've just translated it as a mass of corpses. This would get into the actual physical weight of the piles of these things that are lying around. And then the word here is peger, P-E-G-E-R. That should be a soft one, G-H-E-R. That's the word corpse. It's almost always used of human corpses. It can refer to corpses of other kinds, but almost uniformly it's referring to human corpses. And countless dead bodies. And there does not exist, literally, the more literal Hebrew here, you have a wow plus the adverb ayin, there does not exist. An end or an extremity is ketzeh, the masculine singular noun. There does not exist an end to the bodies. The inseparable preposition lamed plus the definite article plus the word gewia. W-I-Y-Y-A-H. Bodies, it's used of both living bodies and dead bodies. It's used of both men and animals. You have this repetition here, this sort of building, many slain or many fatally wounded would probably be better there. A mass of corpses and countless dead bodies. As one surveys the scene following this, this is what you're going to see. And even, obviously, they would be piling up as you were going through this. But again, it seems to me that Nahum focuses on the actual end event, because while the siege wasn't a long time at Nineveh, it did appear from history that it took about 3 months. But he seems to focus this on the very last charge, as he did in chapter 2, of the very last charge as they're coming in for the final approach. As the cypress spears are brandished and they're rushing madly about in the streets and all of that, and dealing with the fall of the palace, he seems to focus on the very end game, we might say, in the destruction of Nineveh, rather than on. He does deal with it from various aspects in terms of chronology, because if you look ahead in chapter 14, these commands to draw water for the siege, or chapter 3, I mean, verse 14, to draw water for the siege and strengthen your fortifications and go into the clay and tread the mortar and take hold of the brick mold would refer to activities prior to the onset of the attack. And all of which are going to prove to be fruitless anyway. So again, there is very much in the form of a taunt. Do this. I don't care. Try it. See, maybe it'll work for you. And it won't. That's the whole deal. So they stumble over the dead bodies. They stumble or stagger is kashal, K-A-S-H-A-L, to staggle or stumble, stagger or stumble, over inseparable preposition bait, which is normally translated in with or by, but it can have a connotation of over in some context. And then you've got the feminine singular noun construct plus the third masculine plural suffix. They stumble over their dead bodies. The there here would refer to the Ninevites, not to the. They weren't stumbling. Again, we saw that in chapter 2. That question arose is, why did these people stumble in their approach? Well, they had and were in the process of killing very many people. All right, exposition of 2 and 3. 1, Nahum interrupts his indictment of Nineveh, which is resumed in verse 4, in order to provide a graphic description of the attack and slaughter that will occur both inside and outside the city. And again, it seems to me he focuses on the end game here, that this is following the final onslaught, in which the city is taken, in which there's nothing left now. People are fleeing for their lives, if those that were lucky enough to get away. And others that are not so lucky are either dead or dying. Some, as we know, they may take some of the more beautiful women and maybe a few of the elite citizens into captivity, but there doesn't appear to have been much of that going on. They were more interested in the physical plunder of the city, it looked like, from what we have in history. To the explanation as to why the city is all the things that Nahum says it is in verse 1 is found in verse 4, which is followed by a declaration of God's displeasure and disgust with Nineveh in verses 5 and 6. Why does all this come about? Well, all because of the many harlotries of the harlot, the charming one, the mistress of sorceries. Who sells nations by her harlotries and families by her sorceries. Behold, I am against you. And he takes the prostitute metaphor that he introduces here in verse 4 and continues it into verse 5 and 6. 3, Nahum deals with his subject in a very consistent way, using collective singulars throughout the description. The collective noun, of course, is a noun that refers to things or people as a single unit. But we know when he says the noise of the whip, we're not talking about one whip. We're not talking about the rattling of one wheel. We're not talking about one horse or one chariot, even though all of these are singular in the parsing of them. Therefore, when Nahum uses the singular whip, chariot, sword, or spear, he is referring to the entirety of the whips, chariots, swords, and spears that are present. 5, Nahum writes in a very vivid fashion as he records the sights and sounds of what he saw and heard within the vision of Nineveh's destruction. And again, this is divine information that has been communicated to Nahum through the medium of a vision. And he has simply recorded this. But it seems to me that one of the things, as you study the Bible, that when these prophets, or even other people that weren't prophets, even into the New Testament, received these visions. They were very graphic. And it was, I don't know that we could call it, but it was like they were there and they were seeing it, a virtual reality type of thing. That it was all very real to them. That they understood these things. And could write about them graphically because they're literally there in their consciousness. Now, again, how God does this, we're not necessarily told. Sometimes it appears that they're in some sort of ecstatic trance. Other times, you know, this might come to them in a dream or a vision. But, for instance, Peter, when he was up on the roof there in Acts waiting for dinner, it appears he almost went into like a little diabetic trance. His blood sugar dropped or something, and he, you know, saw this great sheet coming down from heaven because he was extremely hungry. That's one of the things he says in there. So God may use, I mean, who knows what all he uses to get these people to this point, but this is all very real to them. And again, he writes in a very vivid fashion because he's right there seeing it. Or at least was, and that he's recorded. So six, his brief and picturesque technique is designed to take the reader right into the very scene that Nahum observed within his vision. And seven, his description has been so thoroughly portrayed in these word pictures that Jerome, who was unfortunately, he was a Catholic commentator essentially, or sort of a precursor to them, has commented that every description of mine is inferior. And so I thought that was a pretty good observation that this guy seen, you know, you can't really improve on this in terms of the reality of it, of taking you, then that's the idea, of course, is to take you into what he is seeing and dealing with. Eight, while many have noticed that short staccato style in which he writes, it should be observed that he describes the battle in a progressive fashion, beginning with the initial crack of the whip, to the final gruesome slaughter. Nine, Nahum first focuses on the sounds of the battle, repeating the noun kol, voice or sound, which may also be translated here almost as an interjection. I mean, you can literally translate it like, listen, hear this, the sound of the whip. What's that sound like? And that's designed to conjure up for the reader in his mind, the sights and sounds that this battle is actually producing. And of course, the initial crack of the whip would be as they were beginning to drive the chariotry forward. And then, of course, we know they would follow with other mounted men, and then, of course, with the infantry, the foot soldiers. So, 10, Nahum begins his description just prior to the start of the battle charge, beginning with the cracking of the whips that urged the horses drawing the chariots to begin the charge. 11, as the charioteers crack the whip and urge their teams onward. The next sound Nahum hears is the creaking of the chariot wheels as they begin to move forward. And you've probably seen enough movies and been exposed to this enough that this conjures, again, I felt it was very vivid. I mean, I can conjure up in my mind the sounds of what he's talking about as you hear these heavy chariots begin to move over this uneven terrain and all that, and you hear the creaking and groaning of these things as they begin their assault. 12, these noises obviously impressed themselves upon Nahum, as he paid very close attention to the contents of what he saw in his vision. And that is, again, one of the things you see in these visions, if you look, even say in the book of Revelation, turn to Revelation 1, and you see John in this same sort of similar visionary state. Which is not really described other than in verse 10 of chapter 1, I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day. And that, believe me, that verse right there has enough controversy surrounding it as to what it even means. The whole issue of what it means to be in the Spirit and on the Lord's day, what the word Lord's day means. And I heard behind me a loud voice, like the sound of a trumpet. And the first thing he gets is the audio. And that's what arrests his attention in this thing. Just as in Nahum, it arrested his attention, just the sounds of the initial onslaught before you get to the very end. And then verse 12, I turned to see the voice that was speaking with me. And having turned, I saw seven golden lampstands. Now the question becomes, as John, we know he's physically on the island called Patmos. We know physically where he's located when he has this vision. How is this all done to him? We're not specifically told. He's in, obviously, some kind of heightened state of awareness in which he's being shown these things by God. Does he leave his body or not? Well, we're not told. And at some level, that's, you know, not germane to the whole point of what's going on. But Paul talked about that, for instance, I think it was at the end of 2 Corinthians. He talks about, and he was speaking of himself, but he was speaking in the third person. So some interpreters haven't even picked up on that he was writing about himself. But he said, whether in the body, he said he was taken up and caught up to the third heaven. Whether in the body or out of the body, he doesn't know. And so essentially, apparently, these visionary experiences could be accomplished a couple of ways. They could literally be removed from their body and taken to some other scene. Now, how that all works, we don't know. Or they could still be in their body and they're just having these sort of ecstatic, trance-like visions. So, again, we're not... But what does stand out is that it's both audio and visual. They're not just... It's not like they're... watching something, they're hearing it as it's unfolding as well. So 12 or 13 here, the horses began to gain momentum, finally running at full speed. I mean, however long it takes them, how many ever yards it takes them to get to full speed, drawing the bounding chariots behind them. 14, although Albright has suggested that the Hebrew participle of daher, galloping, should be understood as referring to the chariot drivers, such is not the case. I'm not real clear on why he got that, but just to point out that there's sometimes the suggestions are kind of out of left field. Sometimes I can kind of see where they get their ideas. Other times I'm just scratching my head saying, this doesn't even commend itself. So 15, his view is largely based on the fact that the Egyptian language has a cognate verb. Which means to travel by chariot. But once again, why go to another language when this word is already understood? So 16, however, the nouns derived from the verb daher indicate that the idea behind the verb is dashing or rushing. And that's where you get it. That's the word there for galloping horses. He's heard the sound of the whip, the wheels as they began to creak and move forward. Now he hears the sound of the horse's hooves pounding on the earth. And this had to be pretty impressive. No doubt the ground shook from all of this. I mean, this is a pretty massive army that's coming in. So Judges 5:22 is one that's, I think, a pretty clear usage of the word. And this gets into, if you have a clear Hebrew usage of the word there that you can pin down, why go start looking in Egyptian or Aramaic or Assyrian to find some cognate? But part of that thinking, unfortunately, is that many scholars do not deem Hebrew to be, in some ways, hardly what you would call a bona fide language. They think that Jews borrowed all this stuff from other cultures, that they never originated any of this themselves, which is nonsense, because one of the things you see, and if this really causes them trouble when they get to books like Ecclesiastes, that are written that are much older than they want to acknowledge, because Solomon was using terms and was familiar with terms that weren't really in vogue for 300 or 400 or 500 years. But Solomon was also a really, really smart guy. And as we know, his ministry there in Jerusalem was very cosmopolitan. There were people coming there regularly from all parts of the empire. Judges 5:22, the horses' hooves beat. From the dashing of his valiant steeds. There, clearly, the sound of the horse's hoof comes from the galloping horse. And so to me, this usage is very clear, and so I don't see any reason to look beyond that at this level for what we have in our verse. 17, although the initial understanding of the noun ra'ash, rattling, refers to the noise made by the chariot wheels, the term is also used to describe the sound that occurs during an earthquake. 1 Kings 19:11. So, and again, that's why I think, if you're sort of there for all of this, if he's, as it were, in his vision, standing on the ground observing it, no doubt he feels all of this as well. Because this would impress itself upon your senses, you know, at every level, not just the sounds and sights of it, but the feel of it. 1 Kings 19:11. So he said, "Go forth and stand on the mountain before the Lord. And behold, the Lord was passing by. And a great and strong wind was rending the mountains and breaking in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a sound of a gentle blowing. And when Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle, went out and stood in the entrance of the cave. And behold, a voice came to him and said, 'What are you doing here, Elijah?'" And so he's got now, and this is what I like to call the Elijah syndrome. "I am the lone defender of the faith, God. This is a difficult burden for me to bear. I'm alone, I'm left," as he says. "I've been very zealous for you. I fought the good fight. And I alone am left, and they seek my life to take it away." And he basically tells him, number one, you're not alone. But I'm going to be with you, and all of this. So Elijah was, again, suffering from what I like to call the Elijah syndrome. I'm the lone defender of the faith. And so I've run into people like this, sometimes very uninformed people, but other times somewhat informed. And they're going to, as it were, straighten out all the errors that pastors have made over the years. Well, I'm not thinking pastors are perfect first. I don't buy that. And I'm not saying there aren't errors that have been made. But I'm saying, generally speaking, I mean, I've been around doctrine long enough now, after some 30 years or so, roughly, to know where things looked suspect to me that I've investigated. Some changes made, some changes not made, because the further study revealed that, you know, there was a bona fide doctrine there that should have been taught. Others, where they needed to be modified slightly. Again, the doctrine of separation, many times for years, was used as a club. And it's a legitimate doctrine and does have to be applied. But people are all too quick. You know, I've had this situations in the past, and also people are all too quick to want to separate from positive believers. And so I've heard people, you know, "Well, I don't associate with this number of people in the church because they're screwed up spiritually." Well, maybe they are, maybe they aren't. I don't know. But the point is, first, if it's positive believers, you've got to cut them a whole lot of slack and give them a bunch of benefit of the doubt, even if you don't always understand what they're doing. So here, back to this deal here. I don't know how I got off on that, but here, back to the idea of the earthquake. That's what this sound can be, this word can be used for that. So 18, as the advancing army of chariots picks up speed, the sound of the rumbling chariots and the pounding of the horses' hooves causes the ground to shake as they approach the city. And no doubt this was quite impressive to observe, and I mean to get the feel of and be there for all that. I've never done it, but I know they play polo out here east of the town, and you can go out, and I suspect you'll be impressed with just even the amount of noise that you hear generated by the horses as they move. So 19, Nahum uses the Hebrew verb rakad, bounding, to describe the movement of the chariots as they approach Nineveh. 20, the verb literally means to spring or leap about or to dance. And so it focuses on the rhythmic movements of the chariots as they sway back and forth. 21, as the chariots push forward at maximum speed, they are bounded around as they travel over uneven terrain, perhaps swerving back and forth to avoid any oncoming obstacles. At some level, who knows if the bodies are starting to pile up by this time. Probably in the initial charge, they're not. The chariots may have been past all that. But as they move forward, it gives the idea, so I don't have any trouble with leaping or bounding here for the translation of this. Even dancing chariots, if you understand what he's saying by the word. 22, while it does not come across in the English translation, Nahum employs both alliteration, using two words that begin with the same letter, and assonance, using vowels that rhyme. And what you had there is Umerikava, Maricada. And so you again, this is the kind of thing that you would only see in the Hebrew, and you only really get as what a great poet he is, and how smart he is, and how he puts these things together by seeing these sounds and these sights. And the on the front of that is actually a wow. So the word itself is Merkava and Merikata. Again, they sound somewhat similar. That's the idea. So 23, in an ironic twist of fate, the Assyrian chariots, which were feared by their enemies, will be no match for the chariots sent by the warrior king. Assyrian chariots were well known as being some of the most fearsome in battle. So 24, as Patterson has noted, the Assyrian battle chariot was feared far and wide. Sennacherib called his private chariot, war chariot, the vanquisher of the wicked and evil. And also he called it the vanquisher of the enemy. So the Assyrian chariotry was quite feared. And again, in an ironic twist of fate, all the things that the Assyrians had been doing, all their chariotry, all their warfare tactics and all of this, are all just going to be turned around on them. And they are going to become, they are going to reap now what they have sown in history. And that is the nature of the game. God is not effectively mocked. You will reap what you sow. And so this is, and again, we say effectively mocked because some people seem to mock God. They seem to get away with it. But ultimately, nope, they'll pay the price. Again, even though that price may be, you know, somewhat delayed down the road, further than we think it should be, we have to leave that up to God. 25, verse 3 begins with the term parash, which can refer to a horse or team of horses. However, in certain contexts, it focuses on the riders on the horses and the horsemen. For instance, 1 Kings 20:20. And I take it here as horsemen again simply because he's already referred to the horses in the previous verse. So the horsemen charging, well, there's two reasons why I take it as horsemen, even though it can be used the other way. One is the horses were referred to in verse 2. And the second is you've got that hypheo participle, which means to cause something to do something. And that would refer to the rider urging the horse forward, not just the horse himself. So 1 Kings 20:20, they killed each his man, and the Arameans fled. And Israel pursued them, and Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, escaped on a horse with horsemen. And there they make a distinction, but the horsemen are, again, the ones who escaped with him. Also, Jeremiah 4:29 is another place it's used, where it seems to be pretty clearly referring to the horsemen, the riders on the horses. At the sound of the horsemen and bowmen, every city flees. They go into the thickets and climb up among the rocks. Every city is forsaken, and no man dwells in them. And there, the sounds of the charge. So, 26, while there can be some difficulty on deciding which is in view, given the causative verb that follows, it makes more sense to translate the term as horsemen. 27, as the charioteers begin the initial assault, they are joined by the cavalry. And by initial assault, again, I'm thinking, given the fact that the siege of Nineveh lasted, you know, somewhat less than 3 months, that again, he's focusing on the end game. He's focusing on what's going to happen just at the time of the destruction that they've been building for, obviously. So they are joined by the cavalry, mounted horsemen that follow alongside or behind the chariots. And then 28, after the initial waves of chariots and mounted horsemen attack, the final assault is joined by the infantry, who brandish both swords and spears. 29, the reason for introducing the foot soldiers at this point is due to the fact that the swords and spears were the preferred weapons for the infantry. And 30, in fact, Assyrian reliefs show their horsemen as wielding bows and spears, but are usually not represented with swords. The bow was, in fact, their preferred weapon. 31, the Hebrew term lahav is used only 12 times in the Old Testament. Now, that is the term that's translated flashing. Again, literally means the flame or tip of a spear or a sword or a flashing bright light. And is sometimes translated as flaming or flashing, as it is in Judges 13:20 and Isaiah 13:8, which would here denote the similarity of reflecting of light from the edges of the swords to the sight of a flame. Deuteronomy 32:41, for instance. So, again, one of the things that's pretty evident here is that Nahum paid great attention to the details of all of this. I mean, these things were really impressed upon him. The sights and sounds of this final charge. Deuteronomy 32:41. Here it's translated as flashing. If I sharpen my flashing sword and my hand takes hold on justice, I will render vengeance on my adversaries and I will repay all those who hate me. I will make my arrows drunk with blood and my sword will devour flesh. And it's also used in Ezekiel 21:15. So, again, the things that stand out to me is the amount of detail and attention that Nahum paid in all of this and how it was impressed upon him. And all that all their hearts may melt and many fall at all their gates. I have given the glittering sword. There it's translated like it's translated as glittering rather than flashing. It is made for striking like lightning. It is wrapped up in readiness for slaughter. So as the army advances, point 32 here, slaughtering as they go, the gleaming of the spearheads is also something that catches Nahum's attention. And 33, apparently the flashing of the weapons of war was impressive enough to distract him momentarily from the carnage that was before him. I mean, as these people are going, those unfortunate enough to be on the outskirts of Nineveh, as the final charge, apparently the wall has already been breached, and they're beginning the final assault into the city. They're just going to be fodder, cannon fodder, essentially. They're just going to be slaughtered as they go. 34, however, that is not very long-lived. The meter of the text and the brief description of the battle does not indicate that it took an exceedingly long time to achieve the results Nahum now contemplates. And the final results, as we see here, many slain, a mass of corpses and countless dead bodies. Again, building up one phrase on top of another to emphasize the actual carnage that's there. 35, in fact, the slaughter and bloodshed was so impressive that the prophet uses three individual descriptions to depict the results of the attack. 36, the first description of the results are many slain, which uses the Hebrew noun kalal to picture those that have been pierced through during the battle. The theological word book of the Old Testament, point 37, notes that the action was generally fatal. The word itself just means to pierce through, but most of the time that's going to kill you. I mean, these people were well enough skilled with their weapons to know how and where to strike. And so very often, of course, that the action was fatal, which is confirmed by the context and circumstantial evidence in most cases. The term also included the act of wounding and the resultant groans. So, no doubt, although I don't think he focuses on this specifically, no doubt Nahum would have heard all that as well. The dying, the dead and the dying out there making the sounds that they are going to make. The shrieks of pain, the groans of agony, as they know they are dying. And that they're not going to be saved. There's no chance of them being saved. So 38, this description would include those that were already dead, as well as those that were wounded and likely going to die anyway. And again, there's not any evidence that they left a lot of survivors on this deal. They weren't interested in survivors. That wasn't, even taking captives wasn't really their goal. Which, they, I'm sure no doubt, again, still they probably took some. Well, 39, the second description moves to the massive amount of actual corpses that are strewn around and inside of Nineveh. Authority, the use of the masculine noun COVID, heavy or weighty, points to the sheer weight of the dead bodies, the masses that are piled upon one another. And again, not necessarily. And in this case, because he's talking about corpses, he really is looking at just the dead, that they're piling, the dead are piling up. Whereas the other term, again, might include those that were just mortally wounded. And 41, as if these two descriptions were not sufficient, Nahum surveys the battle scene and declares that there does not exist an end to the dead bodies. And 42, the author engages in a bit of hyperbole, which is quite fitting in light of the incredible scene of death and destruction that he witnessed. And again, this is just speaking, taking hyperbole, really comes from the Greek hyperbaleo, to cast beyond. And it means to intentionally exaggerate in order to make your point. Now, obviously, there was an end to the dead bodies. It was a finite figure. But who wants to count them? I wouldn't want to count them. Nahum didn't want to count them. And literally, when you looked at the thing, it just looked like this endless waves of death and carnage just went on forever. That's kind of the idea of the hyperbole there. So 43, many interpreters have noted the ironic nature of this comment, as Assyrian records contain many such statements about the extent of their plunder and the endless numbers of people they killed in battle. And they were, again, well, I understand that they probably exaggerated. They didn't contain, these things are lacking, sadly, any mention of any setbacks or defeats. The reality is, I mean, we never read in Assyrian records about those 185,000 he lost there in Israel, as the angel of the Lord went through the camp and slaughtered them all one night. So those things aren't mentioned, and I no doubt they do exaggerate somewhat. But there are so many of these inscriptions, and they are so prolific, that at some point you realize, yeah, they probably did a lot of this. This is all, a lot of this is probably true. So 44, the final statement of verse 3, does not provide a discrete subject. As to who it is that stumbles over the mounds of bodies. But 45, however, chapter 2 indicated that the incoming armies were having trouble getting ahead because of the great number of casualties that littered the ground. That was alluded to there in chapter 2, verse 5. As he talks about, he remembers his nobles, and essentially this was the infantry. We've seen the chariots already rushing ahead. And they stumble in their march, they hurry up to her wall, and the mantlet is set up. Again, this was this is one of the few places, I think, where, again, it's focusing close to the end, but this might be somewhat earlier in the battle than the one we're looking at today. But we're told they stumble, but we're never told why. Well, here he tells you straight out. And so I understood the they as referring to the incoming invading armies, not the inhabitants of Assyria. They might have been stumbling over their own bodies too. But there aren't too many survivors to be stumbling around. And there are going to be a lot more of the incoming armies survive. So 46, in addition, any survivors that might be attempting to flee the scene would also have the same problem of navigating their way through the corpses. And I think it's kind of hard to imagine. I mean, you think, because of the nature of the way ancient cities were and the fortifications, Nineveh's walls were generally about 50 feet thick in most places. And around the gates, where they knew the gates, are more vulnerable and all that, their fortifications were strengthened to double that. Sometimes they're like 100 feet thick at certain places. You're talking about a yard that's 30, a wall that's 30 yards wide. Well, that's a significant thing to have to get through. And so, again, when the walls are breached, you're done. But most of these cities felt, because of the nature of their fortifications, they felt completely able to defend themselves. They weren't that worried about all of this at some level. I mean, they knew that, if you could siege them for a couple of years and had the wherewithal to sit there and wait them out, yeah, maybe. But in this case, again, because of the nature of the records, we know that the siege of Assyria or Nineveh didn't last that long. So I take it as the incoming armies. And again, if you can imagine, you're seeing this scene. Your friends, your relatives, everybody you know is dead or dying, and you're just running literally for your life. And all that you encounter are these massive piles of corpses as you're trying to get out of the city. If you can even make it. Well, 47, archaeology has confirmed what is recorded here. David Stronach, who excavated the site at Nineveh from 87 to 90, has offered the following observations. A, I've never seen anything like this mass of tangled bodies with weapons in the midst of them. The desperation of the defense is now manifest. And again, no doubt some of the Assyrians fought to the very end. Some of them, as we're going to see, the people that should have, you would think that would really make it to the very end, aren't necessarily going to stick around for this. They some of them want to get out, because if you look ahead into chapter 3, your guardsmen, verse 17, are like the swarming locust. Your marshals are like hordes of grasshoppers, settling in the stone walls on a cold day. The sun rises and they flee, and the place where they are is not known. And your shepherds are sleeping, O king of Assyria. Your nobles are lying down. Your people are scattered on the mountains. There is no one to regather them. There is no relief for your breakdown. Your wound is incurable. So, again, as they come down to the very end of all of this, these people are, you know, in such desperate state and desperate plight that they don't even want to consider that what's going to really happen here. You don't want to think about it. B, the final battle was a, quote, desperate struggle. People fell in the most extraordinary sort of jumbled poses. I think the mud brick superstructure of the gate, which was probably burning, collapsed on them. So they have laid buried for the last 2,600 years. And see, there are other bodies that are awaiting excavation. And we can just now see their hands and feet. Again, when they excavate these things, if you're not familiar a whole lot with archaeology, they move very slowly. Because the whole point is they don't want to disturb the scene. They want to uncover it. And so they tend to be very cautious. You know, I mean, if you've seen any of these things or are familiar with it, I mean, they'll literally just go in and use small whisk brooms to clean things away sometimes. Because they're not going to, you know, they're not going at it with a bulldozer. Let's excavate Nineveh. That's not the way you would go about it. So there are other bodies, again, that are awaiting excavation. We can see their hands and feet emerging. We just don't know how far back within the gate this scene of carnage will continue. And for whatever reason, he just worked there through 90 and hasn't either been back or allowed back since. So I'm not sure what the situation is. No doubt it gets into the situation in the Middle East and all that's going on over there. So 48, while there is little doubt that the emphasis is on the complete destruction of Nineveh and the massive numbers of Assyrians that were killed, one must also consider the numbers of the coalition forces that would have died in and around Nineveh. Again, I think the numbers on the invading side would have been far less, but still they would have been, I think, in some ways significant as they come into the city. Some of them obviously would have been killed. I mean, you're going to have casualties on both sides, no doubt. And let's at least get the exegesis of this done. We're not going to get much further than this. But verse 4, all because of the harlotries of the harlot, the charming one, the mistress of sorceries. You've got a preposition men here, which usually is designed to introduce source, and is and very often translated from or on account of. On account of, and then you've got the masculine singular noun construct of rove, which means multitude or abundance. R-O-B-H. And all because of the abundance of the fornications, literally. Zanunim is the word. Z-E-N-U-N-I-Y-M. And this actually has, it's the masculine plural noun construct. It actually has, the term ends with a masculine termination. The word itself means fornications, which is in literal passages, it's used to denote illicit sexual intercourse. You have the broader term, which is fornication, and then you have the more narrow term, adultery. All adultery is of necessity fornication, but all fornication is not of necessity adultery. Adultery requires one married person in the tryst. So, and it's used in a figurative sense to refer to nations interacting with other nations for the sake of political or monetary gain. And the fornications come from the zona, the Zanunim, again, these are the cognate noun and verb are used here, Zona, Z-O-N-A-H, and this means a woman that fornicates, either for fun or money. Now, so, depending on context, you translate this word whore if she's doing it for fun, or prostitute if she's doing it for money. In the context here, the idea looks to be more the idea of prostitution, of nations that prostitute themselves for financial or political or monetary gain. And this is not uncommon. These kinds of charges are not even uncommon. In fact, these are the charges, similar charges, are leveled at us, at commercial Babylon in the last days. And so here, again, while there's not anything I've ever seen that would lead me to suggest that Nineveh has code for the U.S. in certain of these passages, certainly the parallels can't be missed. Because, we certainly can get to the fact that Edom and Babylon are used as code in prophetic passages. Again, the writers of the histories, the Old Testament and all that, could only use words with which they were familiar. There was no term for United States. And these things were known by their ancient terms, and sometimes ancient terms were applied to entities that didn't exist as yet. We don't have a term in the Bible for Great Britain, but we know Great Britain's been a nation for quite some time, much longer than we have. And yet what we see is the lion with eagle's wings in Daniel chapter 6. And so we understand that they would use only what they, well, they could only use what they knew in order to denote these nations that didn't exist necessarily at the time, biblical time of writing. But what does stand out to me, of course, is that Nineveh certainly parallels the types of things that we do. Even if it's not explicitly identified with us, you have to consider the parallels. So all because of the harlotries, well, one of the things I do, I like or don't like, it depends on the deal, is the way they'll try to tone this down because they don't want to offend religious people. So they don't want to say all because of the whoredoms of the prostitute and use very graphic language to describe what these terms actually mean. So again, this is a woman that prostitute, again, in context, I would translate this as prostitute, all because of the many prostitutions of the prostitute. And some nations are far more willing to prostitute themselves than others, as we know. The charming one. What you have there is a good of favor or beauty or grace. You got the masculine adjective, tov. I'm sorry, the feminine singular adjective. It's feminine in this case. Tov. The word itself means good, but the word is used in a broad variety of ways in the Old Testament. And in the abstract sense, it's used to denote desirability or beauty. So they've translated it, the charming one, to get across the idea that this woman is appealing at some level. She's not, and I used to be, back when I was a fundy, I was in this ministry called On the Rock, and we were like the down and outers that got saved, the druggies and the alkies and the convicts and the criminals and the prostitutes. And, prostitutes generally don't look like, that girl in that movie Leaving Las Vegas. They're generally not that attractive. I can't think of her name, but whatever it is. But this woman, in some cases, they can present a great deal of attractiveness. And Nineveh offered this to people. She looked better than she was, let's put it that way. So the way they've trained on the charming one here is good of desirable in, because of grace, favor, or charm. So they've translated it, the charming one. So I don't have any problem with that. The mistress of sorceries is Baalah, which is just simply the feminine form of the noun Baal. So they translate it as mistress because Baal means literally boss or lord. So a female boss or owner, so translate mistress. The mistress of sorceries. The word sorceries is Keshef. K-E-S-H-E-P-H. 13 times. Sorceries are spells. It's a masculine plural noun. It's used figuratively to denote those things which are seductive and corrupting influences. And again, this gets into the idea, because, and he's using the prostitute metaphor, there's a certain amount of seduction that goes into this. And this is one of the things that Solomon spends a great deal of time in Proverbs warning his son about. You've got to be careful about the seductive woman, because this woman will drag you down big time. So the mistress of sorceries, who sells nations by her prostitution and families by her sorceries. So the one selling is a calactive participle here. It doesn't have a definite article, but it is used selling nations, which is designed here to introduce some attendant circumstance, or alternately you could see it as a substantive here. Who sells nations is the way the New American Standard has it. Or introducing an attendant circumstance. Calactive participle of makar. M-A-K-H-A-R. That means to sell or to make merchandise of. That means exactly that. Nations, the goy. We all ought to know who the goy are. Your favorite Jewish word, a goy. Now that's everybody that isn't Jewish. So nations is the way it's usually translated, but it focuses specifically, typically it's used of non-Jewish nations. But in this case, the Jews would have to be included in this because they also sold their nations. So the one selling or making merchandise of nations through her or by her harlotries. Inseparable preposition bait plus the masculine singular noun construct. And then you've got zanunim again, same word we had before. And families by her sorceries. Mishpachah here, the word means family or clan. M-I-S-H-P-A-C-H-A-H. It's a smaller unit than a nation, but it's probably bigger than families. And so sometimes some interpreters want to translate this term as clans or tribes, even see like the tribes of Israel. That term can be used for that. So the one who sells nations through her fornications and tribes by her her spells or sorceries. You've got Keshef again, the term for spells or sorceries. These are things, again, incantations that are uttered in order to bring someone under your spell to have your way with them, essentially. So essentially, what does the prostitute want? The prostitute just wants to have her way with the John and move on. She's not looking for a long-term relationship. She doesn't want, you know, romance. She just wants to plunder her prey and move on. And in that regard, Nineveh very much fulfills this, as they had throughout their history. Okay, well, our time is gone, and we'll be ready to dive into that on Wednesday. Thank you, Father, for this time together. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.